สสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะอภารุธาเดทังอมัทสัทธาวราเยโสระวันธาบัมุนจันทุสทังThis is the full moon of August, and the 1 month of the Vasa has already passed since we entered a month ago in the full moon of July. A very rapid, very fast month, at least for me. So there's 2 months left.Enter the second lander, second You want to just sit there with your finger on it. High tech. This also is the family summer camp week, and many people are here in this very hot weather. So it's also something to contemplate, this, the existing conditions as they are, and then to recognize that our relationship to whatever is in the present is one of harmlessness, mindfulness. We're opening to the experience of whatever is happening, either externally or internally in our own minds, to really be in this position of the bhuto, the knowing state, the state of awareness. This, I think, is very, this is someone who's been meditating for many years, this becomes increasingly more clear, this state of awareness and the value of it. So that's why here in the UK, where Buddhism is a relatively new phenomenon, and Buddhist meditation is something that is, people are now beginning to have some benefits from their practice, insight, wisdom, understanding, through the persistent and ongoing reflection on the impermanence of conditioned phenomena. And the Dhammajaka Sutta that we just chanted is, of course, the essential teaching, suffering, the causes, cessation. And cessation is as you develop the pavana, cultivate the way, then they experience a cessation becomes increasingly more clear. Where when we're in the beginning, we're mostly caught up into the arising conditions and just the momentum of habitual thoughts, emotions, opinions, views, behavioral patterns that we and reactivity that we experience in this life. The aim of a religious path is to realize the ultimate, the deathless reality. So in the realization of Nirodha, then we have insight into the path, the Eightfold Path, based on right understanding, samadhi. So this word ditti is it can be right thought or even in the Thai language, they use it as a kind of like opinion, view, or even conceit. In Thai, when you say someone has a lot of ditti, it means they're very opinionated and conceited. Now, in Thai, they actually use the word ditti, or mana ditti, a self-conceit. But samaditti is right view, or right understanding, right seeing. It's profound. It's embracing. It's not divisive. It's not based on delusions anymore, but on insight. And the tendency for us that when we think about Dhamma, oftentimes is to divide the world into illusion and reality, or the thinking mind is always making these divisions because of thought. And that's how what thought actually does. The function of thought is to divide and separate, to count, to qualify, to quantify, to describe, to define, to limit. But the spiritual realization is unlimited. It's not defined. It's realized. So that's why the ultimate realization is something that you can describe or define. Or every attempt to try to describe it in words. In any language, it's somehow not quite that. So, and the Buddha made this very clear, it has to be realized and known individually by the wise, Bhajjatang Vaitidapo Inyuhi, to be experienced individually by the wise, to be realized, to be known, because it can't just having definitions and descriptions and ideas about it tend to delude us. Because whatever we attach to, whatever view we have about ultimate reality, that view will in some way distort the experience. Because we get prepared for seeing it in some way. We've got some bias, some little distortion that we're using to experience the present. And so ultimate reality, or the enlightenment or realization, is impossible as long as there is any form of clinging to a view, to any form of ditti. And of course the kind of dittis that we have are, you know, we form a lot of opinions and views about Buddhism and about Dhamma, about monasticism, about other religions, about ourselves, about other people. And so these are kind of conventional ways of thinking and defining the conditioned realm. Though the conceit of dittimana is always thinking that because we know about all kinds of things that we actually understand them. So you get people who are very well educated and have degrees and certificates, and have written books and are considered authorities and experts. In terms of spiritual development, it remains merely ditti or dittimana until you've let go of it all and realize the reality in the present. So that always the meditation, say the purpose of a meditative practice is not, if you're coming from the basic ditti that distorts experience in the present, is the self view. I am this body, I am my memories and feelings and thoughts and emotions, and the way we grasp the things around us, the external world, what we see and so forth. We get possessive, we identify, we hold to it. So in the monastic life, where, we kind of, most of us aren't particularly fascinated by having a lot of possessions and identities on the social or worldly plane or material plane, but our ditti can really be strong in terms of our station, our commitment, our practice, our view about practice, our view about other people's practice, our views about Buddhism. And all these views, and nothing, even the views may not necessarily be wrong in themselves, but it's the grasping of those views that is the distortion. Views are views, so they're appropriate according to time and place. And some are based on, intelligent reasoning and on using language and dhamma and convention in a skillful way. But still, as long as one is bound to the convention, that blind attachment to convention, even no matter how good the convention might be, there's still a distortion. There's still the ditti there that hides the reality. Now in the third noble truth, the Nirodha Satya, cessation, this is where you're actually realizing non-attachment. The second noble truth is the insight into letting go of the causes, the gama dana, pava dana, vipava dana. So this paha is the letting go, or not grasp, it is actually like letting go, putting down something. Not destroying, it's not a destructive thing like getting rid of because it's bad, or it's not a kind of judgment, value judgment against any convention or condition, but it's the thing that the attachment, this blind attachment, is the thing that blinds us to the reality of the present. And so there's a sense of awakened awareness, the sati, the appamado, the heedfulness, being heedful, paying attention, being awake is the way that is the kind of essence of Buddha Dhamma. Buddha, Bhutto, awakened, awareness, wisdom, mindfulness, these are the words that have great impact on the meditator. And we can still grasp these words and create all kinds of Buddhas and all kinds of opinions about Buddha and all kinds of views about being mindful. And so even though we have these words, it's like being heedful, paying attention, being here and now, and then we grasp the views of you must be awake, you must be here and now, must be mindful. And then that very grasping is the thing that makes us heedless, even though we're grasping a view about mindfulness, or grasping a view about not grasping. So it's not a matter of negating or just going from a positive view to a negative one, or taking a position in terms of a particular viewpoint as being some kind of view as being absolutely right. But samma ditti is not grasping any views. It's the state of pure being. They say in one book a kind of ontological transparency, kind of attempts to use words like transparent, not ontology, like the present and the study of being. Transparency. There's no, it's not color, it has no color, no form, no shape. So it's not something that you find or create. You can't create mindfulness. It's not something that you do, but something you be. You rest in it. You open. You relax into the state of receptive awareness, intuitive awareness. It's intuitive. And then from that, then the samaditti is possible. Once you actually trust yourself to be in that state of just and in that state of attention, you're accepting everything for what it is, even your own tensions, your own negativity, like if you're a physical pain or restlessness or whatever you're experiencing now, the intuitive present is embracing. It's not condemning or making any kind of problems about what you're experiencing in the present. And that's quite an amazing ability, isn't it? To just try, because oftentimes we feel tense and then we start grasping the view that we should relax. And so if we have bad thoughts in the present, then we think we've got to get rid of them. Or if we have, if we feel pain or negative feelings, emotions, or whatever, we immediately take the view that we've got to get rid of these kind of conditions. But that's coming from the conditioned mind, isn't it? You make judgments. You know, this is bad. This is good. This is how I should be. I shouldn't be like this. It's easy to. We have the Pali words. We say this is an asava. This is a defilement. This is a kilesa. This is a sin. We're very good at naming, putting some kind of word to the what we're feeling in the present and making some kind of judgment about it. But in intuitive awareness, it's non-judgmental. That's why we say intuition. It's embracing all that's present, all that you're experiencing without judging it. Good, bad, pleasant, painful, peaceful, or confused, or light or dark, whatever. It's not selecting. So one can understand this and even feel inspired, but
But how to really practice in this way, to make this into a reality. And so, say, in our life, here at Amaravati, this particular situation is set up in order to encourage and point to that and keep reminding us, because we keep forgetting. It's easy to get lost in all the worldly urgencies and problems and difficulties that we have. And communal life is a real challenge, isn't it, in terms of the way we are living together and the way we affect each other on an emotional plane, and all the conventional things we have to bend to and accept and embrace inevitably bring up all kinds of resistance or attachments or obsessions. So then this is the beginning of the quiet week for the monastic community. So it's just to see this as an opportunity, the quiet week where, say, maybe the pressures of communal life are not so great, not so strong. You're not forced or compelled. There's not expectation for you to be the morning chanting or evening chanting or things like this, and you can motivate yourself. Let's say this is a wonderful opportunity for you to instead of setting up all kinds of ideas what you've got to do during the quiet week in order to get something, to trust more in your ability to just be aware of, say, any compulsive feelings. Doesn't mean you don't have need to do anything during the quiet week, but to whatever you decide how you're going to use this week to really observe the kind of way of feeling, and not judging, just observe. This is the way it feels when it's like this. This is when the pressure's off, or when I have time to myself. This is the way I feel. We have these various meditation techniques, sitting and walking practices, and so forth. These are helpful ways of disciplining and having something to do, but the aim of these things is not to be caught in compulsively practicing, but in observing the compulsions, or the laziness, or the resistance, or the kind of way one can make excuses or rationalize yourself into justifying to justify your behavior. But trust more in that which is aware of all this, all that listens and is aware of the way your mind tends to react to experience. And as listening, the sotavanta is not judging it, it's not making and if you do tend to pass judgments, be aware of that and also accept the reactive habits you have to the experience, so that it's embracing. And but your refuge isn't in the objects, but in the pure state of awareness. Now, to realize that state, to know when you're in that state of awareness, you can just by just by developing just practicing in the state of just paying attention, listening. Because the ability to listen is a very is quite expansive, isn't it? It's when we're listening, we can listen to something in particular, or we can just be have that state of just pure state of listening, of attention. So then, all that is heard is accepted in that openness. That open state of listening. If we're just concentrated on some particular sound, like what somebody is saying, that's concentrating on maybe a speech somebody's giving. But also we can just rest in the state of awareness, that expansive listening of the Sotawanta, which isn't listening for anything in particular, but a relaxed state of receptive listening in the present. So it includes all the sounds, including the birds and the wind and the noise and the traffic, and it's just not excluding. It's willing to allow all that is present in terms of sound to be what it is. And then as we relax into the state of receptive awareness, then we begin to detect the sound of silence, the kind of buzzing sound, kind of background that we don't tend to notice and not aware of, usually. And it's natural to us, it tends to be like something that we've never really recognized or seen, other than maybe some kind of strange electric sound. But it works very well in terms of meditation, because it's a sign where your mind is kind of the conditioning of the mind has kind of reached its edge. It stops there. Like thinking will stop there. And then there's a sense of being poised in a state of pure attention, pure listening, which isn't listening, which isn't trying to absorb into the sound of silence, but using it as an edge to rest in, a kind of a balanced place, where your ability to really be totally receptive and in an expansive way in the present is realized through that. And as you relax with that more and more, then you also can reflect on the conditions you're experiencing, like emotional reactions or thoughts, because that sound, the sound of silence or that emptiness of the mind, isn't an annihilating. It's not an annihilation. It's not a rejection of anything. It's not going into a kind of void of nothingness, of blotting out all conditioned experience. It's not annihilation. But it's the realization of emptiness that embraces everything. So that all the other sounds are within that, are the old sound can take you to that sound of silence. And as you develop heedfulness around the sound of silence, then your relationship to the sounds, or to even the internal sounds, like the inner voices, the emotions that you're feeling, the thoughts and views, the dittis that come up into your consciousness, you're now willing to let them be what they are. So you're actually letting your mind kind of free itself from this endless controlling, manipulating tendency to based on fear, based on ignorance, based on desire. Because when you're caught in the self-view and in the wanting to control everything because you're frightened of life and experience or frightened of your own feelings or emotions or thoughts, and that then one is continually resisting, you know, and trying to as soon as any frightening thing starts coming to consciousness, we try to get rid of it, run away from it. But in this state of natural awareness, then even the most frightening emotional things are allowed. You know, they come up. They are what they are, and your relationship to them is knowing them in terms of impermanence and not self. They're conditioned phenomena, anicca, dukkha, anatta. And you're letting them be what they are, so they naturally cease. And as you trust in your ability to let things cease, and rather than just when things get rough, to kind of rush off to do something else, that's what we call rebirth, isn't it? Where we get some frightening thing coming up, and then we try to take this, and we run off and do something, keep busy. Write letters, read books, run around the field, phone up an old friend. These are what monks and nuns can do. We don't have television. If you're a layperson, you've got television, you can immediately switch it on. Also the subtleties of negative feelings and repressed desires and that are allowed then rather than judged or controlled. Because from this place of sotavanta, then you're the listener, intuitive awareness, then you can deal with with subtleties, with stupidity, with all kinds of inferior emotional habits or immature emotional habits that we might have. And we're very good at judging and saying, this person has immature emotions, and so when they get upset, they start throwing a tantrum, or they... When they can't get their own way, then they act like this, we're very good at kind of analyzing, putting labels on that they have problems with authority, or they have problems with their mothers, or the problems with these kind of this way of thinking tends to. Make it sound like we shouldn't have these problems, and therefore there's a tendency to try to solve all these problems. But then the problems keep multiplying all the time, so that because the basic. Problem has not been resolved, which is attachment to the conditioned realm, or the ditti, attachment to these various mana dittis. So you can be quite cavalier, and these little immature emotions or big immature emotions start coming up, and you say, "Welcome, temper tantrums." I mean, not that one has them. You know, you don't see me going around usually having temper tantrums. But still those kind of emotions one can experience. So they come up, and the attitude towards them is, rather than trying to get rid of them, seeing them as my problem, being not resolving my immature habits from childhood traumas, I begin to accept the, and kind of welcome these emotions into consciousness. It's like you're being a host, a generous receiver, without judging and without making any conditions about it. It's like unconditioned love. And then these emotional habits, once they're, if they have no resistance, no, and you're not creating problems around them out of ignorance, then they actually are being liberated from your karmic storehouse. At least I find that in this way, the kind of tendencies, inadequate tendencies, can be reduced, can be let go of as I stop trying to control it. With all of us in a society like this one here, where say we have a lot of, you know, say we haven't really been, we have a lot of freedom, and we have rights and opportunities and material abundance and things like this that we almost take for granted, you know, the kind of privileges of a democratic system and material wealth, materialism, modern life. And so, this kind of acculturation that we've had, say, it tends to have its own problems. You know, we sometimes can bypass difficulties. We can get by in this society quite easily without putting much effort into our lives. We again just kind of ride along, and we can become obsessed with ourselves and in our feelings and our thoughts, and become really self-centered and very selfish, because in modern society, for many of us, life has allowed this kind of luxury to be self-obsessed, to be obsessed with one's views, one's opinions, one's feelings. Now, how to use this, you know, in terms of Dhamma? Because in the monastic life, you know, we're all here because we want to be free from this pain, because selfishness and self-obsession is a very painful way to live one's life. And then it's always separative, and it's critical, and one is so caught in endless comparing, comparisons, and jealousies, and envy, and self-disparagement, and embarrassments, and self-consciousness, and arrogant attitudes, and conceits. So that kind of conditioning just creates, even in a modern and pleasant society that we live in, creates a lot of anguish and despair and fear, even though the kind of the dangers aren't particularly immediate. You know, you're not on a survival level. You don't have to worry about, you know, wild animals attacking us and just trying to get enough, you know, a few grains of rice to survive the next day. Sometimes, you know, when you're really hard-pressed, life gets difficult, and you're just on the survival level, you don't have time to be neurotic. you got to try to find a crust of bread or something to survive with, and you don't have time to feel sorry for yourself. But in modern life, we can indulge in ourselves in these self-obsessions. Now, this can also be a good thing if we use it in the right way, because, like they hear in the monastery, it's very well, you know, it's provided for in life. Isaya Amrabhati isn't survival on the level of just not, you know, getting enough to eat and not having, you know, just barely making it on the level of survival. But in terms of emotional experience, isn't it? Sometimes it's difficult to survive. Because we are living in a community where we're altruistic, we're moral, we have a lot of good qualities. We're here, we're spiritually aspiring, you know, we're all quite good. Our intentions are good, and our aspirations are for realization, for enlightenment. And yet, how much anguish we have around the jealousies or envy or just the feelings about being misunderstood or not loved or not respected or not appreciated, or being, we get paranoid, we think people don't like us or people are against us or people trying to take advantage of us. All these kind of emotions are quite ordinary in a community existence. So the Sotawanta listens to this. You know, I train myself to just listen to the anxieties, the fears, the sense of responsibility, the compulsive tendencies I have, the desire for approval, the longing for people to understand the Dhamma, you know, all the kind of things that you have, you know, that wanting, you know, that you've kind of committed yourself to this particular way of life, and then that also brings up emotions of wanting people to appreciate it, or wanting people to understand. And so these kind of desires and these dittis are part of the path. And so in terms of Dhamma, it's all, we're seeing these things not in terms of personal defects, but as developing the path. So all of what you might consider your personal defects and your inadequacies and your problems on that level, is rather than seeing them in that way, see them as all the dhammas that keep reminding you of the path. So then, in the state of awareness, then all the immature emotions arise. I feel upset because people say somebody criticizes me unfairly, and then. Being criticized unfairly, then this emotion of it's not fair, it's not right. Then the Sotawanta listens, and this emotion then is accepted. It's not believed. I don't believe it. It's not in believing or in resisting it, but in accepting, in allowing it to be that way. And then it naturally ceases. It's something that is always helping you to realize the path. And this, if you change your attitude, rather than from the self view, which is a good monk shouldn't have thoughts like this, or a good nun shouldn't be like this and all that, the way that then we're actually using the conventions of monasticism to develop to increase the sense of a self and to increase the self disparagement. Because you know a good nun, a good monk is very high standard that we would like to become, and then we just endlessly feel we're failing or we're not good enough, and because we can't maintain ourselves at this high standard that we're attached to. But in this state of awareness, then the high standard, the emotion, the immature reaction, the whole thing, in intuitive awareness, it's embracing the totality of it. It's not making a problem about the problems. So all problems and views that are very high and altruistic or just petty, selfish, mean-hearted opinions and views or whatever they might be in their quality, they're all, when we see them in terms of Dhamma, then it's all path, it's the samadhiti of not having a view but seeing directly the way, seeing the path as a present, here and now, timeless, and trusting that. And only you can know that yourself.